With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, just a very dead week. Happy everyone gets to do something besides from Syracuse Athletics for a week.
Yeah, happy figuring out what exactly happened this weekend week. There's not a whole lot going on. Friday, fall camp starts for Syracuse football. That's pretty awesome. There's plenty of hype that continues to build around the program. And it's nice to see some of that. So we'll definitely discuss a bit of it here on this episode. But I think first and foremost, Dan, Boeheim's Army lost in the Super 16, fell short of the Final Four for the fourth time in five tries. Didn't even make the regional final, which is unfortunate. Well, I guess they did make the regional final, but not really like super regional final, whatever the format is. In any case, didn't reach the equivalent of the Elite Eight, which is a bummer. It seems like the zone defense did not work for long stretches of time. Shots weren't falling. Having three games in 3 days really did seem to exhaust the bigs, who were all, you know, kind of late 20s, early 30s guys. In general, it seems like this is a little bit of an inflection point for how the team's constructed. Now, I wrote a little bit about that, but curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, going in, I think we were pretty excited about like the additions of guys like Andrew White and Mike Benajay, BJ Johnson, like those kind of sharpshooting wings. And we saw, you know, they all had their moments. Like BJ looked really good. I thought White had some big plays. Benajay was a little more quiet. I think what we've learned, if anything, over these last couple of years is this is, I mean, and basketball in general has become this, but this is such a guard-dominated tournament. And our guard play, aside from like last year when John Dillon had his crazy run over the last like year or two, our guard play isn't always up to stuff. I thought Jordan Crawford had some moments, but there were times where he looked like he was trying to like kind of take the whole game over and wasn't quite at that place where he was good enough to do that. I thought the the Brotherly Love team just looked so much more. They had way more stamina. They were faster. They were super aggressive on the boards. And I don't know what the like age difference between our teams were, but like you could just tell the difference in terms of effort. Even when we were shooting, you know, pretty well in the first half and we're keeping it close, it's so hard to win a game when you're getting out rebounded like 3-1 like we were. And the bigs definitely lost their legs a little bit between days two and three. And I don't think we played back-to-back-to-back days in previous years. Whatever the new layout was, I think definitely hurt us. Because in game two, I thought Watkins had an awesome game and was a real presence. And then he was pretty ineffective in game three. AO was having trouble getting up and down the court and obviously seemed to have some issues with like the refs. I think it's definitely a time to kind of retool. But it's tough because generally you want to keep this like mostly in the family. I don't mind having like a Willie Reed or a Willie Dean, rather, or Crawford jumping in to help out. But you want this to be like a Syracuse-focused thing, and I don't know that we have like the right type of guards floating out there outside of like Diefendorf and Gillen and whatnot who are ready to play. So you kind of have the hand that you draw. It did help that Trish, I think, who was been very good in this tournament before, was not hurt. But ultimately, like, it's not like you can go out and like recruit all these guys who are like floating out there, almost like, you know, battles available in a year or two or whatever. So you kind of have to play with the guys you have, but without like the explosive guard play, I think it's always going to be a little tough for us when we're this roster has been so forward oriented the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I talked about some of the issues and what might need to be addressed this off season. But you know, for next year, I think not having Trish, not having Chris McCullough, ready to go. I think that definitely played a role here. I don't know if it's a deciding factor, and a lot of folks said that given how Trish has been playing over in Italy, that having him in there could have been a difference maker. That very well might be true. I don't necessarily think that, you know, all the having so many older guys, I feel like carry a lot of the load here when we had so many younger guys coming in. Seemed like a little, not to question Blackwell or the team construction too much, but didn't necessarily seem like the best, you know, use of the roster. I think they're like Jim Boeheim even alluded to, like they needed to shorten the bench. I think there was just too much. There were too many players coming in and out. There was also just the fact that, like, chemistry wise, like most of this team was added pretty late in the game this time around. And I feel like in previous years, maybe we had a little bit more time to practice and you know, a little more cohesive. Team Brother Love's been practicing together for months. A lot of these other teams that have gone far in the event have practiced together for months. And like you said, too, that 3 games in 3 days format just really, I think, broke down, you know, a team that's a little more reliant on veteran players like ours is. I personally think, like, we're at a crossroads just in terms of, like, what we want this event to be and what we want this event to be for Boeheim's Army. Like, I think having all Syracuse players keeps fans engaged. I think it makes it one of the more exciting teams and one of the more exciting alumni teams. But I guess, like, now we have to ask ourselves, though, like, what's the point of the event? Is it just to have, you know, former Syracuse players out on the court for 3 to 5 or 6 games? Or is it to win? Because I feel like if it's to win, I'm just not sure if the current batch of, like, former Syracuse players, you know, bouncing around the G League or international play is necessarily going to be able to get that job done. So if people are fine with, and that includes the players, if they're fine with, you know, likely not winning the event, then I think you can stick with, you know, an almost entirely Syracuse laden roster. I think if you want the bigger goal to be win, I'm curious if at this point we've reached an impasse where you might have to make it like headlining Syracuse guys, but maybe, you know, an extra body or 2 or 3 or even 4 that, you know, are folks looking to catch on to a team and maybe make some money in the process.
Yeah, it's a tough balance because I don't think it's going to have the same impact if you have, like, even half and half. I think you want the base to be Syracuse guys. It's not going to feel the same if it's, you know, a bunch of just, like, ringers thrown in there. I don't think maybe 1 to 3 are that big a deal. And maybe if there's, like, a C.J. Massenburg from Buffalo in a couple of years is looking for a team to play with, or, like, a guy from Siena or something, maybe that helps make sense, or a guy who's, like, local to Syracuse but didn't go there. But you don't want it to become, like, a, you know, it's based in Syracuse and, like, has, like, a background that wear orange, but you don't recognize half the players. So I think, honestly, like, ultimately for Syracuse fans, I think seeing the Syracuse players out there is the thing, and then winning obviously enhances it. But, like, the fan support's only gone up, even if we've had, like, up and down tournaments. And having it in Syracuse, hopefully something they'll do again. I mean, I once the dome renovations happen, we've talked about this on Twitter a bit, a bunch of people in the community, like, they could easily sell 10, 12,000 tickets, I think, to this if they had a Syracuse Boeheim's Army hosting at the dome. Like, there's no doubt in my mind they could have an exhibition SU game type atmosphere there. And probably more rowdy, too, because these games get really exciting. But at the same time, you don't want to lose, like, the Syracuse-ness of it all. So it's a tough balance to strike. And then going back to your first point, like, I kind of agree with the shortening of the bench. I thought, you know, well, you can probably make the argument that Warwick and Diefendorf were our two best players throughout the tournament, and they're both in their 30s. Obviously, Warwick kind of, I mean, he only played, like, 9 minutes the second night, so he was a little fresher, I think, in Game 3. But, you know, they're not going to be there forever, but I think they can play as long as they want because they've shown they're just so good in this tournament. But beyond that, I think it would have been nice to see, like, more Dylan, more Johnson, more of those younger legs, Benajay even, who I don't think really got a chance to really show what he could do, versus worrying about every guy coming in and out. And honestly, maybe, like, if they're going to stick with this 3 games in 3 days format, maybe having, like, you know, these are our guys for Thursday and Saturday, and we'll try to focus on other guys for Friday just to keep, like, someone's legs fresh for each game might be a way to do this versus, like, trying to run out everybody and play everyone 20 minutes and then, you know, kind of falling apart in the second half on Sunday. So definitely not the way you want it to go, but ultimately I think this tournament's more about just fun. I mean, for us, it's easy to say we're not the ones competing for, like, 150 grand each, but for the fans, I think it's more about, like, the fun camaraderie of the Syracuse fan base in the summer and kind of a thing that cuts the offseason in half, more so than even winning. Obviously, we want them to win, but I don't think we're going to be like, well, if we never win this, it's not worth doing. Because it's so much fun for even the couple days that we had it this summer.
Oh, yeah. I think you make some great points there. I actually didn't really think of like the kind of like, you know, Thursday, Saturday, or like just the separation of days, I think is a decent solution to keep this Syracuse-centric while still like putting the best team out there. I do think just raises the question of like, you know, who is this for? Is it for the players who can earn money and get, you know, scouting opportunities? Or is it for the fans who are going to show up and help keep the event afloat? I think that that unfortunately those goals might serve two different masters. I'm not entirely sure. And I don't think anyone has like a perfect solution there. I do think, you know, it's going to be interesting as some of these older guys kind of cycle out of the you know, Boeheim's army setup, who kind of takes their place. Cause I know like, you know, Diefendorf has kind of been like more of an assistant coach, like mascot almost, and losing him was like kind of the heart and soul of this, this team and this idea, would definitely, knock maybe some of the affinity, if nothing else. I think just to kind of summarize here, getting rid of the zone is probably a good idea for this team. Anyway, especially if you're going to be involving, like, again, older players who haven't played in the Syracuse zone in quite some time. People forget that the zone isn't like some magic elixir that you can just take before a tournament game and then automatically like win. Like, it takes the practice and time and talent and athleticism and everything else that, you know, so the kids that work under Boeheim every day have. And it's no offense to the guys that, you know, didn't make it happen in this tournament, but you're not necessarily just going to carry that through, you know, into your 30s with a bunch of guys that you only started playing with like a week and a half ago. And then, yeah, the youth movement stuff, like I think I already said, just I'm very curious to see what this team looks like in a few years and how maybe a younger crop of players and with maybe a different mentality could potentially be better and maybe even could be worse depending on who we get and how the tournament continues to evolve and whether the Elam ending shows up again. I think there are a lot of factors. I think the Elam ending in particular has really changed this event. And unfortunately, I don't think it's changed it for Syracuse's benefit here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it benefits us at all. Obviously, we've won some dramatic games with it. And we've definitely lost some, though. I don't think the Elam ending really had anything to play in the brotherly love game. They just kind of dominated us. But I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I think it's one of the, like, the signature things of this tournament that sets it apart and that people are interested in. And when you have like a thing you can kind of explain that's like different than any other basketball we've seen every summer, I think that has a sticking point. You know, we have to remember also that they wouldn't have new players cycled into this field every year. So, like, obviously we're not rooting for guys to, like, drop out of their NBA careers early, but in a couple of years we could have Tyler Lydon, we could have Malachi Richardson. You know,
let's get Melo in this thing next year.
Oh, God, Melo would make... I know Melo, like, I think we brought this up every week for, like, 2 months now. Someone please sign Melo and just give him a last year in the NBA. It's getting ridiculous. He deserves one last year. You don't have to give him the Dwayne Wade treatment. He probably doesn't deserve that, but, like, give him, like, let him play himself out of the league. But then after that, Melo would be just unbelievable. You know, like, if Melo played and they put it in the dome, they would probably sell 18,000 tickets.
Minimum, to be honest.
Yeah, it'd be nuts.
They blow the roof off the place, and honestly, Melo would be the best player in the field.
Melo would either be the best player in the field, or he would just play, like, he would just not come back on defense at all, and it'd be kind of sad. But if he wanted to be, I think he probably would be the best player in the field. Yeah, I mean, that's the dream, but like beyond him, like we're going to have new guys available every year and hopefully we keep it fresh. And I know Belby's worked really hard. He thought, you know, we were talking about last week, like the additions we made this year were really impressive on paper. It didn't work out totally, but I think we're still kind of finding ourselves. It may have to touch a team once he retires in 18 years.
Yeah. It was interesting to have him there. It was interesting to have him like kind of weighing in a bit.
I really enjoyed that, like, I think it was Greenberg that was like, oh, yeah, the Dias can just jump back in the zone. Like, they haven't played, like, it was yesterday they were playing, and Boeheim gets on the mic, and, like, one of the first things he said, I think I think it was Friday, was like, oh, they really shouldn't be playing zone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a reason he's a Hall of Famer, and it's because he understands, like I said in the article, like I said on here already, like, the zone works in a time and a place. And there's circumstances beyond just being in a tournament that make the zone effective. And I think, like, because of the recent random success in the tournament, it's kind of become this like weird, like rabbit out of a hat to people, and that's not at all what it is. And it was good of Jim to you know, refute it there, at least on the broadcast, not so much on Twitter. But then it was...
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes, quote-unquote Jim Boeheim, after about 12 hours after saying they shouldn't be playing Zone on TV, said they should definitely be playing Zone on Twitter, so you can read between the lines on that one. Oh, God. It's also a much different animal when you have, like, 35-year-olds not closing out versus, like, obviously we have 20-something-year-olds not closing out in Syracuse games, but when it's really on, like, the Zone looks so much different when you have guys who've been practicing it for months on end, years on end, versus, you know, guys who are, you know, have other things on the line in the TBT. Like, no one wants to get hurt. Obviously, we saw Perry Ellis get hurt in the Kansas alumni game, and they ended up losing in the first round. These guys have other careers to go back to, so it's a little understandable while they're playing hard, obviously, and overseas elite, those guys have all made small fortunes on this thing now. You know, guys, most of these guys are playing overseas, or they're playing somewhere, so you it's understandable that, like, they're not going to be sprinting out on every closeout, but it does make it's a different experience watching the 2-3 when it's guys just kind of relearning it for the first time over the last, like, 3 weeks or so.
Yeah, I think that anyone at this point harping on the Zone as, like, a signature for this group, like, to be honest, including everyone involved with the team, like, and I love all those guys, and obviously, like, it's great to be involved with them where we can, but, like, if we're going to stick to the Zone, like, it's not going to work. So maybe that's the fix. And then you can scrap the rest of my ideas and any other ones and just invite all Syracuse players, don't play Zone, and you might actually be better off. But I think in any case, this team's going to look radically different in some way, shape, or form next year.
I think it's fine to have as a wrinkle, and it's, like, kind of a funny little thing. And it's worked, you know, we've had some deep runs in this tournament, but ultimately, these guys are playing man-to-man pretty much everywhere they're playing right now. Obviously, I don't know all these European teams inside and out, but I assume most of them are playing man most of the time. So even with the background of, like, Syracuse's Zone team, like, these guys aren't playing Zone all year. So I get why the inclination is there, but it doesn't really benefit anyone to, like, try to shoehorn the BAMS Army team into the zone when they're probably picking it up, what, maybe a month before, probably not even.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to put it in a football terms, this is like having a team. This is like having guys play pro style offense for 15, 16 years and then bringing them back to run a spread, you know, no huddle offense, like, decades after they ran it the last time. Like, there's no, like, it's not like there's no connective tissue, but there certainly isn't the same amount of connective tissue anymore once you put some time between, you know, when you last played Zone and the amount of basketball experience these guys have had since then.
Yeah, it also kind of goes against, like, what we always say as Syracuse fans. We're like, when there's those lazy criticisms of the Zone as, like, being a, you know, low effort defense or, like, whatever, Bomani Jones, who I generally love, his Zone stuff is so ridiculous and petty. But, like, by saying, like, oh yeah, they should just roll out the Zone like they played 15 years ago, like, that kind of goes against everything we all know about the Zone. It's not easy. It's not something you just, like, go say, oh, go do it. Like, Boeheim Zone is attacking, it's aggressive, it's fast. It's all the things that, like, go against the stereotypes that people have of it. So then to say, like, oh, these guys who played for Syracuse between, like, 1 and literally 15 years ago should just go be able to go do it, like, perfectly, it just doesn't, like, that doesn't add up. So hopefully we'll see some adjustments next year, but ultimately, like, it was still a fun event. Everyone who went up there seemed to, like, have an awesome time, and I know there are people who flew in from, like, Alaska and Texas and everywhere else in the world, which is crazy, but that should really prove what the Syracuse fan base is all about. And then, like, honestly, even if Boeheim's Army bowed out early, I think the Syracuse fan base is, like, a real winner in this whole thing, because it was no joke. People saw what this fan base does in the middle of July when there's no basketball on the horizon for months. They were out there packing SRC, and I have no doubt they would have packed pretty much any arena in upstate if they wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of props to Syracuse fans for really showing out to this. Other fan bases showed up to their respective events, but I think Syracuse really got into it, really kind of showed out on national television, had, you know, the camera on them and definitely delivered. So I think, you know, it left a really big impression on the inbound freshmen. I don't know. I wasn't paying enough attention to see if they had brought any potential recruits up during, but it might not have been a bad idea, you know. And I think I forgot who said it, of one of the new freshmen that was, you know, just talking about, like, you know, once you play here, you're a legend for life. I think that is something unique to Syracuse and something unique to the family aspect of the program. Hopefully this actually pays some dividends, even if we don't see them for a couple of years. I think having this event up in Syracuse in particular really does, you know, get those eyeballs on the fan base, maybe in ways that just others can't necessarily match, at least at the volume, even if they do with maybe the same passion.
Yeah, it was cool. I hope they get to do it again. Obviously, I loved having it down here in New York. I went the last 2 or 3 years, and even in, like, in Brooklyn, at LAU Brooklyn, like, there'd be probably 2/3 of the arena would be Syracuse minimum. So, anywhere on the East Coast, you're going to have SU fans, but having it in Cuse, you really saw, like, the full... I mean, you had people standing outside for, like, 4 hours before tip-off because it was general admission, which is just, like, awesome. Like, it's just... I don't think you get that everywhere. I think you'll get, like, you know, really good fan support wherever they host it. I'm sure Wichita was cool, having Kansas and Wichita teams there. I don't think... all of them were quite into it. And we've been, like, kind of, even without winning it, like, we've been one of the foundational blocks of this whole tournament. And I assume the TBT people would say that too. It's been, you know, we're one of the first big programs to latch onto this thing with an alumni team in a big way versus, like, having a handful of guys.
Agreed. Well done, SU fans. And we'll see everybody for it next year. Before we get to halftime, just wanted to focus quick on football recruiting. And the fact that, unfortunately, we struck out on Bryce Gowdy today, today being Tuesday. Sorry, it is trash day. And one of my neighbors has decided to pick this exact moment to take out the garbage. But, yeah, we missed out on Bryce Gowdy. For those who, unfortunately, watched that horrendous live stream where a camera person was in front of the god-awful stream the entire time, it was so fuzzy and the reception was so bad that you could not really hear anything that anyone said. I mistook one commitment for another because you honestly couldn't hear anything again. It was pretty horrendous. I would highly recommend people don't do that, which would be, you know, picking a random bar with questionable reception to try to host a live stream that had 4,000 people watching it. And expecting it to work without, like, professional equipment, because it definitely did not. But yeah, Bryce Gowdy, 4-star receiver from Florida, is a fringe top 300 guy, would have been the best recruit in the class by a long shot. Unfortunately, he picked Georgia Tech. For those who are surprised to hear that, they have a different system now. They're not running the option anymore. So players actually want to go there because it's in Atlanta and it's a hub for, you know, obviously football fandom, plenty of scouts, things like that. So that's a bummer, but these things happen. SU did get 2 3-star commitments over the weekend, which puts us around the top 60 or so in the country with 13 guys committed. I think that's fine for now. I think we're going to be playing the long game on a lot of blue chip guys. My only fear there is that if we don't land those guys, I'm not really sure what we're going to have. I'm not sure who we're going to be able to close on late if for some reason, like, we don't land some of those blue chip guys, because I know, like, especially at the quarterback position, there's not necessarily anybody left that we have a good shot at in this class, which is going to become a persistent problem as more, and I know we've talked about this, as more quarterbacks continue to want immediate playing time, and we have our second straight kind of entrenched quarterback at the top of the depth chart now.
Yeah, quarterback could become a tricky issue, especially if DeVito leaves early. It's obviously very, very early to say that he will or will not. We have to see how he plays. But, like, if we just miss a quarterback in one class, which I know is not ideal, I don't think it's the end of the world, especially, I mean, we've discussed this before, like, with the number of transfers at that position, I think there are more guys available after the fact than there have been before. So I think we could afford to miss out on guys and not take, like, a flyer on a guy we don't really think can fit in the system. You don't want it to go 2 years, though. Like, you want to ideally add a quarterback every year, and then just so many guys do transfer on the other end of it. including at Syracuse, that you want to like make sure you always have guys to fill in those spots. Like you said, we got a couple commitments this weekend. Ben LeBrosse, the safety from Canada, from Montreal, was unranked when he committed, and I just pulled up our 24/7 page, and he is all of a sudden our number one ranked recruit, so people bet on that pretty fast. He's number 603 in the country, so he's actually pretty far ahead. We also got Stephen Mahar, who is our number two ranked recruit, who's a tight end at Rochester, number 33 tight end in the country. So, you know, our last two commits are our two best commits according to the rival, the 24/7 rankings. Doesn't mean everything, but it's, you know, I guess you'll take it. It's a nice sign. Like you said, I think we are playing a little bit of a longer game on some of the top guys on our board. That is a tricky, we've seen some of our other coaches go in both directions with it, and that could be a tricky game to play. But last season, I think we got our two best guys, at least on paper, Michael Jones and Lee Podba. I think they were both pretty late commits, weren't they?
Yeah, we got both of them in November. Neil Nunn recommitted in November as well.
Yeah, so those were our top three guys. So yeah. It's not like, you know, there's no, A, like this isn't really outside of the classes we've gotten. And also having 13 guys isn't like a huge class at this point. There are teams with well over 20. But this isn't like, you know, I don't think it's quite cause for panic yet. No. I think the quarterback thing is like slightly disconcerting. But there's a lot of recruiting time left.
Yeah, a lot of recruiting time left. But I think the quarterback thing, I know the last 2 years we've had late flips kind of help us out. Chance Amy's already out of the program. Meanwhile, David Summers is still here. I think Summers seems like a better chance to stay, if only because we flipped him earlier. There's some other connections there. I know his like personal coach.
He's also local.
He's more local. His personal coach is the same as DeVito's personal coach. Realistically, like I think, you know, Summers knows what he's getting into, where he's sitting for a minimum of 2 years, probably. And just in case, like DeVito leaves after a stellar redshirt junior year, who knows? But in any case, yeah, I think a lot of quarterbacks, especially like the blue chip guys, they want to put up big numbers, but they look at that and they see Syracuse as a place they can do that. But unfortunately, just because of, again, the fact that we had a 4-year starter and then have what's potentially going to be a 3-year starter, nobody's necessarily looking to get themselves into that fight when it seems like there's already a clear starter who, especially in Tommy's case, you know, has the pedigree and the recruiting background to back it up. So we'll see there. I think that we still have a chance to close on plenty of blue chip guys here. But at the same time, like, I don't want to necessarily miss out on, you know, more attainable guys who are still like high threes. I mean, again, you know, this just like everybody else does. A lot of SU's best players have been, you know, your mid to high 3-star play guys over the last decade and a half, some of them even lower. So, you know, Dino's staff has the unique ability to combine, a solid recruiting uptick with a really good ability to coach guys up too. Like they know how to take advantage of talent, but at the same time also know how to coax more talent out of guys. That's not usually a combination you see, especially like at the Syracuse program range. It's usually one or the other. So it's definitely great to see. I just hope that, you know, we start seeing that like tangible talent upgrade start to swing up further if we cash in on another, like, you know, 8-9 win season.
Yeah, and sometimes the benefits of recruiting kind of play out, or the benefits to recruiting kind of play out like a full year ahead, because like obviously the coaching staff, generally speaking, like in earnest, gets started on the, like, we got really started on the 2020 class last off season. This off season's like we're really drilling down in 2020, and then we're starting on 2021. So next February is where we're really going to probably see most of the results of this past season, just because they have like the full cycle to sell that 10 wins and hopefully back it up with another nice season this fall. So you don't always see like the immediate recruiting bump the year after a big season. It's often the year following that where players have a full, like, you know, the full cycle to digest it, versus like you win 10 games and you're trying to rush into this kid's, you know, text messages when they haven't really heard of you or weren't really considering you before that because, you know, you were a 4-win team. So it's, I just wouldn't get concerned about recruiting rankings in general at Syracuse, just because we have such a unique set of obstacles to jump over to, like, really hit where some of these other programs are, and we're also very developmental. But also because I don't think the 10-win season was going to magically reverse our fortunes overnight. It's a little bit of a slower burn than that.
Yeah, I agree. In all likelihood, we're looking at, you know, late closures on this class, and then, you know, 2021, assuming Babers, et cetera, are all still there, that's when you start seeing like a huge, huge jump. If you end up having another 8-9-win season where we're top 25, then people start seeing SU as a solid, stable, rising program. And again, that's when you start cashing in on that potential. Before we get to halftime, why don't we take a little bit of a break for a word from our sponsor? And we're back. So, Dan, what have you been drinking?
Not a hugely active week on the beer scene, because I was and am still kind of recovering from this stupid never-ending cold I have. I did have a couple different things from Half Full Brewery in my hometown of Stamford, which were brought into the city. Notably, their Supernova and their Within Reach, which are two of their better offerings. One's a sour, one is a pale. And then I had a couple of metrics from Industrial Arts. Industrial Arts is a Pilsner offering. Not my favorite thing from them. I'm not a huge Pilsner drinker in general, but Industrial Arts does everything pretty well, so still very enjoyable.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't have like a super, super busy weekend. I had some wine that I had brought back from Italy last year on Friday, celebrating our anniversary. And since my wife was pregnant right after I got back from Italy, wasn't really able to drink it for 9 months. And then, you know, want to actually enjoy it. So we saved it for our anniversary. It was pretty good wine. I don't really remember any of the details on it, but that was pretty good. Had a Stone Tropic of Thunder Lager, a Firestone 805 Blonde. I was at a really good Mexican restaurant and had a couple Mexican craft beers. Had the from Aguamala, the Serena Pilsner, that was pretty good. And then the Perro del Mar from Wendlot. I think all of these were from like the Yucatan area of Mexico. I know that their general like theme in the restaurant was that. So I'm assuming they probably got most of them from there. That was an IPA that was pretty good, actually, from Mexico. So Mexico's upping their craft beer game. Those were definitely enjoyable. Also had a really good gin and tonic at the Mexican place, which you would not think, but I was impressed. The whole thing was put together by him, like kind of theatrically dual wielding gin and tonic in a way that seemed aggressive, but again, yielded a good gin and tonic, so I was fine with it.
Very nice. Yes, I will be a very different look beer section next time I'm on in 2 weeks, because I will be in Italy next week. Probably drinking a lot of wine as well, but I don't know that I'll remember any of the names of them. But I will mark down the beers as I try them. I know you've given me a pretty decent list to look out for.
If you hit one of those, the Ma che siete venuti fa, the one in Rome, is probably former Noon's Magician contributor Aaron Goldfarb will also attest to this. It's one of the better beer bars I've ever been to.
Oh, okay. Well, duly noted.
So that one is definitely worth going to. But yeah, there's plenty of beer in Italy. It's a growing beer scene, but obviously you're there for the wine when you're drinking. And I wouldn't blame anyone for indulging more in that. I know I did for like the first half of the trip when I was there last January.
Oh, it will definitely be a wine-heavy trip, but, you know, there's not every day I can go try beers from other countries besides, like, the stuff that it's over here pretty readily. Not that I'm going to, like, you know, I don't think I'm going to be looking out for, like, Peronis everywhere, but I'll definitely look out for some of the other more hyper-local stuff. And also, like, I'm going to want a beer now and then. I can't drink that much wine.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. Well, Dan will be enjoying Italy next week. And we will have Kevin on, actually. So you'll get an even more confusing episode where Kevin and I sound very similar on podcast. So we'll see how this goes. I know at least Dan and I sound different enough where you can tell us apart. It's honestly tough with Kevin, so we'll give it a shot, though.
Kevin will be the one dropping Drake references while John's the one dropping Kanye references. It's going to be the easiest way to figure this out.
That's fair. The second half of this podcast today is about, I think, at least my favorite non-ACC conference, and maybe Dan's too, the Pac-12.
As of now, I wouldn't say, but like historically, maybe. It's just not been great in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, they're fun at the very least. Like,
they are fun.
The game's still enjoyable, even if like the conference just can't get out of its own way lately.
I think the Big 12 might have eclipsed it for fun, although the Big 12 has the problem where like Oklahoma's just so much better.
Right.
Everyone, not to go into this too far because we've talked about the Big 12 already, but like the Pac-12 is still probably a little more balanced in terms of like most games you don't know is that going to win, even if Washington is involved, like they strike together enough like iffy wins that it's not like they can just be handed anything. But I think even the brand of play in the Big 12 might be a little more fun over the last 2 years. But, you know, I'm not going to turn down a Pac-12 After Dark game after I've gotten off a long work shift watching other conferences. I will almost always stay up for it unless it's like Oregon State, Colorado. So yeah, I mean, I love the Pac-12. It's a nice like a pair of teeth for a good college ball event.
Yeah, it's fun. It's weird. I think it allows me a chance to actually go to a live football game the same Saturday as covering Syracuse, because usually SU games are on much earlier for me, while the Pac-12 games are on later. So there's always a chance that I can go see a USC or UCLA game, although I'm not doing much of that lately, based on the reason that you just heard in the background. But Dan, who do you – I guess we'll just start at the top. Who do you think is going to win this league? Because I feel like Washington is an overwhelming favorite, but like Oregon's lurking. Everyone's pretty high on Utah, but I don't know if the Utes have really brought in the level of talent that makes them runaway favorites in the South, even though the rest of the teams in that division are potentially a train wreck.
Yeah, I think Utah, the strength in Utah is that the South is just a mess. And I think Utah's not a mess. I just don't know what their ceiling is. I think they're a very unique Pac-12 team in that they're like the Big Ten team of the Pac-12, which besides Stanford, obviously, but there's some utility in that and being like different. And they're just very steady. I just don't know that they're going to reach the ceiling to beat whoever the North champion is. In the North, I think it's going to be Washington, Oregon. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the post-Jake Browning dogs are. Obviously, Jacob Eason was a 5-star recruit. He was at Georgia, basically lost his job because of injury. Jake Fromm stepped in and was really good and led them to the title game. So you kind of understand where Eason's coming from when he transferred back home. To Washington. So we've seen some flashes from him. It's hard to like, we don't have a huge sampling of what he can do. And he's been at Washington for a bit now. So there's talent there. I just feel like Washington's lost so much around the quarterback position over the last couple of years. It's going to be kind of interesting to see how they recruit, because they've had such strong receiver play and such a strong running game over the last couple of years. I think Oregon might be the most interesting team. And one I'm kind of leaning towards, obviously Justin Herbert is a potential first-round pick, but I thought they were really not that far off last year. They had some like first-year jitters, I think. Obviously losing, what was the Stanford game they lost was just absolutely.
Oh brutal. Yeah, that was just a brutal mistake-laden game that, like, really, if they, I'm looking at the schedule in front of me, if they had won that game, they would have. And they still wouldn't have won the division, but they would have been 6-3 in Pac-12 play, and they would have had a 10-win season. So
it kind of felt like that. It didn't like derail them. Obviously, they had some nice games after that, but things like, I think if they had won that game, they would have picked up like so much momentum. It would have been you could almost see like the rest of the season looking a little different for them.
I mean, they beat Washington, they're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, so like I just don't think they're that far away. So I kind of like Oregon. I obviously usually talk about this at the end, but I think in an effort to be a little different, and obviously it's not going out that far on a limb. They're Oregon. They've been really good for, you know, 2 decades now. But I kind of like the Ducks to kind of raise up here. I think Chris DeWall has quietly done a really nice job there after that. Like, his first game was as interim head coach, and they got bludgeoned by Boise State in that bowl game, and that kind of raised some questions. But he was a good head coach at FIU. He was experienced. it's not like the most obvious fit. He's not from there, but he seems to have done most everything right since then. And I think we'd be talking a lot differently about them if they had not lost that Stanford game last year and if they had really challenged Washington for the division last season.
Yeah, I mean, they're a different type of team. Like, obviously, like, you know, the Michigan State 7-6 bowl win is, like, horrendous. But for the most part, like, they're a really solid, like, team that I think has, other than Washington, has the, like, highest floor of anyone in the Pac-12. I think that, like, recent recruiting, you're not going to really see the benefit of this maybe for another year or two. But, you know, they recruited, right, like, recruiting right now, like, a top 20, top 25 level, which, like, they were really weren't doing a ton of, even under, like, Chip Kelly and, like, in the early part of the Mark Helfrich regime. So, like, this is a very different program than what we saw even at its, like, peak. I think Washington's still recruiting at a much higher level. Stanford is, too, to be honest. But Stanford, recruiting just looks a little bit different because, you know, it's usually a lot smaller classes. They're getting four-year guys, and it can look top-heavy because if they end up, as they did a couple of years ago, I think they had like a 13-player class, and like four of them were like five stars, so therefore like they looked like an insanely good class, and they were based on like the average talent. But at the same time, like because of how everything works at Stanford, that talent is matriculating slowly. But yes, I think Oregon's a year or two out from really having like, you know, you could be looking at the Ducks as a potential national title contender by next year, even without Herbert. I think Washington is just so well coached by Peterson that I think that they're still the odds-on favorite, and they just have so much more talent than everybody that isn't USC, which is probably a good place to go next. The Trojans have a difficult schedule, and I think if they lose more than four games that – Clay Helton's fired.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, honestly, like even 8-4, I don't know that would save his job. I think it would depend on what those eight wins were.
I think if they go 8-4, they have a chance to win the South. I think if they win the South, that's enough to keep him around.
Yeah, I mean, then you have like one of those really tough things. The question is like, are the Urban Meyer rumors real? Like, if you can go get Urban Meyer, put aside all of the moral implications of that. Which I think USC would gladly do.
Happily.
I think USC would not be that concerned about it. You probably make the move unless Helton does something where you like just can't fire him. If those aren't true, then I think USC is a very attractive job. It's just like they just make such weird hires all the time. What was the last non-weird hire? We discussed this enough, but like even Pete Carroll was a weird hire at the time, and obviously that one worked out. But like, they're just such a confounding team where every time there's a potential opening, it's bandied about like, oh, they could, you know, this guy or this guy or this guy, and they never do. They take someone either just ripped from their family tree or someone just kind of confounding. I mean, I guess Kiffin, like, people got why.
Also, but,
like,
weird.
It was still weird enough in that they were getting the guy from Tennessee who just went 7-6 to Tennessee, was run out of town in Oakland. And, like, yeah, he was a terrible guy, but it wasn't like he had done so much at Tennessee in one year, aside from, like, run up a ton of recruiting violations, that you would say, like, oh, he was definitely, like, ready to take that step.
See, Oregon would have, like, Orgeron would have made sense, not from a, like, where he's from standpoint, but from the fact that he came in, took over, did so well standpoint, that, like, it would have made sense to hire him instead of Helton.
Orgeron would have made sense in the same exact way where it made sense when LSU hired him. Like, he got, you saw enough there where you're like, he, you know, might be the guy, and if he's not, we'll find out pretty quickly. And at LSU, like, I think there was reason to think that wasn't the most inspired hire, but he showed enough post Les Miles where you're like, let's give him a year, and we're LSU, a worst case, if we can dump him pretty easily. And I think USC could have done the same thing. Instead, they let him walk, and they went with Helton, which, I'm still not totally sold on Coach O, but I think Coach O has shown at LSU that he's kind of learned what he doesn't know, and he will surround himself with like really high level guys like David Randall.
Helton tried that this offseason, admittedly. He didn't know that his offensive coordinator was going to get hired by the Arizona Cardinals.
That's very fair. That was a very inspired hire that lasted about a month.
Well, I mean, we talked about it at the time. Cliff is made for this place.
Oh, Cliff at USC was going to be so exciting.
Clifford USC was going to be so excited because then you were going to get the
– inevitably got the head coaching job somehow?
Oh, yeah. Like that happened, or just like the TMZ stories every weekend.
Cliff hanging out with like Jimmy Garoppolo somewhere and two people to be named later.
No, it would be Cliff and Jared Goff just like balling out every weekend in Hollywood. But, oh, God. Yeah, the last USC hire that made any sort of sense is probably Paul Hackett.
Yeah, which
and still like, yeah, like I mean, Hackett made sense at the time. He's from Vermont, but he went to UC Davis and played quarterback there. He was an assistant at USC from 1976 to 1980, and then after time as a position coach and a head coach in the NFL, he came back to USC in the late 90s. So Hackett sort of made sense. And that's, I mean, he made sense. And Larry Smith made sense too. Because Larry Smith went from Arizona, where he coached for 6 years, to USC, where he coached five. So, like, Larry Smith also made sense. But it's been a while. Yeah, at this point, we're looking almost 20 years since a USC hire has made any sense. Obviously, we're talking about USC a little bit more because the obvious kind of, you know, elephant in the room is that if Clay Helton's fired, if Syracuse wins like 8 or 9 games, there I think is a decent likelihood, assuming the Urban Meyer rumors are false, that USC's looking at Dino Babers. USC is on the like very, very short list of schools that can hire him away. And I'm not going to worry about it, if only because if Dino has us winning 8 or 9 games, then that's certainly a pretty good parting gift, and it has us pretty well situated on the way out.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't lose your coach to USC, like it's kind of like you just put your hands up and say, like, we did what we could, especially if, like, the what we think his pay is like, based on, like, what's out there, sounds very competitive. Like, there aren't going to be that many schools that can just go win. Like, we're not going to lose Dino to, like,
Northwestern, which they wouldn't fire Fitzgerald. But the point being, yeah, we're not going to lose him to a peer program, and I don't even think we could lose him to like the bottom half of the SEC. I think there's really like at the top half of the SEC, USC, Texas, Oklahoma, and like the top third of the Big Ten, and that's it. Like, I mean, I'd say Florida State too, and Clemson.
Yeah,
that's really it.
Yeah, the schools that really worry me, like, I don't think Texas, I don't think Herman's going anywhere. Riley was to leave for the NFL, I don't know, I think Oklahoma would probably go bigger. I think they would either keep it in-house or they would go bigger with it. USC scares me enough, but I think the Meyer rumors are our friend. Auburn, I think, honestly, scares me more than anywhere.
But if you're Dino, don't you read that? I know we've talked about this a million times. If you're him, don't you read that situation and go, there is no winning here?
Yes, you definitely are concerned about that.
Like at least at USC, like you can go 11-1 and be a legend. If you win a bunch of Rose Bowls, like you're great.
Yeah.
At Auburn, if you win a bunch of Sugar Bowls, but Alabama played in 3 playoffs in 5 years, you're fired.
Auburn's a great, great job the second Saban retires.
Oh, 100%.
Another place that scares me a little bit, and it's not, he has kind of connections there. What if D'Antonio is out in Michigan State? That would scare me a little bit.
I mean, a little bit. They definitely have the money to hire him. It's just whether or not. But he's got to, it's the same, it's the Auburn situation, just like with better expectations.
Yeah, although there's no one entrenched there like Saban is at Alabama.
Like, no, but I mean, just in terms of like Michigan, Penn State, and Ohio State are so difficult to get past that like you have to hope for a perfect storm to do it.
Another scary one would be James Franklin has some USC rumors around him. If Franklin went to USC, Penn State's scary.
Oh, I mean, the Penn State would hire him in a second. There's zero chance that we could hang on, which would kill me. I would hate them so much more than I already do.
That would be tough because they're kind of like they're not a rival anymore, but they're like they're right there, and we have to recruit against them all the time. For like anyone that's like on the bottom fringe of their place and on the top fringe of ours, we are always against them. So yeah, that would be really annoying. But there aren't that many places. Like, I think there's maybe 15 to 20 schools in general, regardless of situation, they have to be kind of worried about. And then once you plug in like situation, it's far fewer. So it's not anything to like super, super worried about. And USC, I think we are probably putting more connections in there than like USC fans are. I don't think Dino Babers is like the top of Reign of Troy's list. If I haven't looked and seen what they've written about it, but
I've talked to a decent amount of USC fans, and everybody knows who Dino is.
Yeah, but I think that's because they're talking to you too.
Yeah, that's fair.
If they weren't talking to a Syracuse person, I don't know that he'd be like the number one guy. So we'll see. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Helton's toast though. Like Helton needs to do a lot this year, and I don't know that he has the depth of program to do it right now.
Fair. Speaking of coaches that could be toast, I think surprisingly, and this could be another scary one. UCLA, what the hell is going on with Chip Kelly?
I mean, you know way better than me being out there. From the East Coast, it seems like UCLA is a little more patient, but I think Chip needs
not lately.
Okay, fair enough. I think either way, like UCLA doesn't necessarily need to go win 8 games this year. I think they need to show a like serious step forward in terms of on the field ability, even if it doesn't totally translate into like big wins.
They need to make a bowl game.
The South is so open. Yeah, like a bowl game I think is reasonable. But in the South, like there are so many wins on the table. Like you would hope, even if it's not like a huge leap forward, that like you can pick off an Arizona school, and a couple of these other schools that are kind of lost in the abyss here.
That's a problem. Like Colorado has its own issues that we've like discussed in previous years. The Arizona schools are always going to be like kind of talent poor and have to hope that they can catch enough kids through the cracks, you know, in Southern California. Like we've said this too before, like UCLA and USC have no excuse to not have two of the four best recruiting classes every year because of the local talent pool. But like, yeah, UCLA should be able to, in theory, pick off. Like, but then you look at the schedule, like at Cincinnati, that was dumb. Like San Diego State at the Rose Bowl, that could be dumb. Oklahoma, that could also be dumb. Like they might have scheduled themselves an 0-3 start to the season in non-conference before they even get into conference play, which starts with tricky trips at Washington State and at Arizona. You might not win a game until October 5th against Oregon State. And then
that's really hard to recover from.
Yeah, like once you do that, like you're mostly screwed. I mean, last year they started 0-5 and then finished 3-9.
I wonder how in the ear of the UCLA brass Kelly is in referring to this exact thing, because I don't think any of those games, except for maybe the Cincinnati game, were scheduled when he was hired. Like, I think those were already on the books. And even if you were like scheduling Cincinnati when time ends and like people didn't know where that program was, Cincinnati's usually pretty good. It was a pretty safe bet that Cincinnati would at least be respectable.
Are you going to Cincinnati?
Yeah, that's a dumb game. Oklahoma is not, I mean, I get where you probably settled that a long time ago, and like it seemed like a good idea at the time. So you write that one off. San Diego State's not going to ever be an easy game. That team's never terrible.
Like, that was actually a recent schedule. Like San Diego like got games against all the Arizona and all the Southern California schools like on the schedule like very recently.
We should hire that person.
Yeah, seriously.
We should hire their scheduling person.
Like, yeah, you seem to figure it out. I had to fix last minute scheduling. No, I think the problem with UCLA too is like their recruiting class this year was a joke. Like I know Bud Elliott's talked a little bit about this. Chip Kelly thinks that he's still like Oregon's Chip Kelly. So he swung for the fences on all these kids and then didn't have a plan B set up.
Were they the ones who, I remember Bud writing this. I don't remember exactly what the thing was, but I'm pretty sure it was that they just didn't offer anyone. Like they just didn't bother offering. Like a third of the players that most schools do. And then when they missed a lot of them, they just didn't have this is why you offer a million kids. You want the groundwork like laid. And that's why you have things like non-committal offers and you have all this other BS. And like, maybe that's not the best way to do it, but realistically, like you have to play the game everyone's playing, because when one school has 300 offers out to fill 20 to 25 spots, and a lot of kids think they can go there, and you're UCLA and you have 87 offers out, and a lot of kids, maybe you hear from them once in a while, but don't actually think they can go there. Like, you're putting yourself way behind the eight ball for when you miss.
Yeah, so they could be screwed if not now. Like, when this class, which is like far behind what like Jim Mora was getting at the back end of his time, like when that class becomes like your veterans, like that could be a little problematic. Like, even if it's not right in this immediate term, it could be very problematic like in a year or two. When you have like a top 50-ish class compared to your like top 20-ish classes that Mora was bringing in.
This is the Wilhelm stream coming from Pasadena.
Yeah. I know we have to wrap up here, but Dan, so you're going with Oregon, and assuming you're going with Utah?
Yeah, I'm going to go Oregon over Utah. I think the North is just so much better than the South. Even like who's the worst team in the North? Probably
Oregon State by a mile.
Oh, it's Oregon State. Yeah. Okay. Who's the second?
It's always going to be Oregon State.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about them. Oregon State also in the conference.
You know what? The second worst team in the North could be
Cal.
It's either Cal, Stanford, or Washington State. Yeah. I think Cal could actually be pretty good this year.
All those teams are probably better than the third best team in the South. Like,
I'd say the second best team, to be honest. Maybe. I realistically, like, it's probably a toss-up between USC, UCLA, like, Cal, Stanford. I feel like all four California schools, like, I feel like they're all hanging in that 7-5 range this year.
Yeah, because, like, I think Cal, who has been pretty rough recently, there was just a thing today where Sonny Dykes basically said he wasn't a good fit there, and that's an interesting thing to see someone admit.
Because we kind of knew that when he got there.
Yeah, no, we knew that when he got there, but, like, you kind of talk yourself into it because you think that offense travels, and it doesn't always. I think Wilcox has done a really interesting job there and has kind of really reshaped what you think of Cal football because he's a defensive guy but seems to appreciate the offense and whatnot. So I think Cal's definitely interesting, and you could easily talk me into them being on the same, like, par as USC if it's USC's second-best team. And at worst, they're not that much worse. So the North is just so much deeper. I am going to Oregon over Utah just because, like, the South, like, I just can't think of, like, USC obviously is the most talented team, but I'm just not going to buy them. They just haven't proven it to me. So I'll go with the Utes. I don't think the Utes will be great, but I think it'll be like a 9-win team. And I think Oregon will snipe out Washington again and probably finish with like maybe 2 losses, maybe 1. I don't know. I can see the Pac-12 kind of eating itself again, though. Which is, we talked about this with like all these leagues, like, you can really talk yourself into the Big Ten, Pac-12, or Big 12 missing the playoff, maybe 2 of them. So, I would not bet on the Pac-12 making the playoff, but the path is definitely, I think Washington's the most direct path, but Oregon, you could see where they're coming from here.
Yeah, I mean, Washington has the schedule to do it. They're the smart school in that they schedule Eastern Washington, Hawaii, and at BYU. That should get them to 3-0 in non-conference. They do have road games in conference at Stanford, at Oregon State, at Colorado, at Oregon. At Oregon State. So sorry, Stanford, Arizona, Oregon State, Colorado are the road games. That's pretty manageable. Stanford being the toughest of those. So then your toughest games: USC, Utah, Oregon, Washington State are all at home. This is a team that even if they take a slight step back, could still go, 11-2 with a Pac-12 championship game win, or even 12-1. I think the only problem with the schedule, obviously, is if you're competing for a national title, people don't look at the Pac-12 schedule all that fondly. They don't look at this schedule in particular all that fondly. If they lose one game, I think they're going to struggle to get into the field. If they can run the table, then obviously, they're looking at, a 2 or 3 seed.
And that is why we're going to get 9 a.m. kickoffs out there. So I hope you're excited.
I mean, I'm already up. So it doesn't really matter. It's just
to run directly into our ACC network kickoffs.
Yeah, I it's such a dumb idea for a lot of reasons. We've discussed there's better things to do on the West Coast than just watch football games. And like, I love watching football games, but like everybody else is busy doing other stuff because the weather isn't like it is everywhere else in the country in the fall, where you can just do the same thing you did in the summer. So everybody's doing that, and you have, you know, kids' soccer games and softball practices and everything else that happens on a Saturday before your team, and most of the people out here being from the West Coast in a lot of cases, like, your team plays later. So you do all the things that you would normally do on a Saturday and then enjoy your team. And, you know, if you're a super fan like myself or other people, then you watch all the games. If you're a Big Ten fan, an ACC fan, you watch most of the games. But, like, realistically, like, you can't have any California schools start that early. Like, getting up to the Rose Bowl or to the Coliseum for a 9 a.m. start is a non-starter. Like, absolute non-starter.
I just think if you're the Pac-12, like, you can't pretend like you have the same general football culture as the SEC. So you have to lean in on, like, giving the product to the fans who want it versus, like, trying to be like slate of games that all the non-partisan fans are going to watch. It's just not realistic. Like, you have to, like, make sure you're locking down the Pac-12 fans and giving them the best experience versus, like, trying to nab, like, the casual college football fan, because they're probably going to watch the SEC game or the Big Ten game instead.
You and say that, but when they're Beijing's college team.
Yes, or you open up the Chinese and Australian markets and then you make us all look stupid. But in that case, like, time zones are even more different.
I mean, I can't wait until Arizona State renames themselves the Kangaroos or some shit.
The Sun Kangaroos. It's a more dog-like mascot.
Herman says,
shot across Ackman's bow real hard.
I forgot all about that. Yeah, they. Although I we don't need to go into this right now. But where does the kangaroo logo and the zips thing,
like,
where do they meet in the middle?
I don't know. Also, UMKC, I think, is also the Kangaroos.
They are, and they have, like, well, they used to have a Walt Disney designed logo.
Love that there are multiple kangaroos, although one of them is the Zips. Also, KC just does by the ruse, which is great.
Yeah, that's actually pretty dope.
It's pretty great.
Big fan of them. Anyway, that was fun, Dan, as always.
Yes, the only Pac-12 preview podcast where we will discuss University of Missouri, Kansas City.
You're welcome, listening public. Dan, anything else? Anything else before we leave?
No, look forward to listening to next week's from probably a plane on the way back from Italy. Feel free to tweet me recommendations for Florence, Rome, or Milan if you are on Twitter. I will probably not take them because I have a very full schedule, but I will acknowledge them and thank you.
He's a man of the people. Dan, have fun in Italy. I am jealous as always. And everyone be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Spotify, on Stitcher, on any other podcast store that you might listen to us on. And go Orange.
Forza Azzurri.